My name is Tom McGarry. I'm running for the Washington House of Representatives from the 6th Legislative District, Position 2. My background, a little bit about my background, I was born and raised in Rawlins, Wyoming. My father was a railroad engineer, and my mom was, not employed outside the home, but she worked very, very hard. In high school, I worked throughout high school and in college. I went to the University of Wyoming, graduated from Wyoming in 1982. I moved to Spokane in 1986. It was love at first sight for me. I moved up here to go to law school at Gonzaga and have worked and lived here ever since. I did marry one of Spokane's native daughters, Mary Wisnick. We got married in 1994, and so we are now at 26 years. I'm an attorney. I'm McGarry Law Office. I'm an attorney that does primarily housing law. I represent landlords, property owners, and housing providers in the Eastern Washington, Greater Spokane area. And I'm also a twice elected fire commissioner for Spokane County Fire District 9.
So what has that taught you?
Being elected as a fire commissioner has taught me a lot. That's a really good question because, you know, you go in and you look at budgets of millions of dollars and you have to realize, of course, that these are not your dollars. These are the public's dollars. And it makes you keenly aware, I think, that you have to be very careful about what you are going to spend things on. How does it benefit the public? In the case of the fire service, how does it promote public safety? And how does it promote safety for our employees? Our guys and are on the front lines. They have an inherently dangerous job, and we need to do what we can do to help them. The other side of it is that I've learned is that as a nonpartisan position, we work together. I mean, we don't look to see what the Democratic or the Republican talking point is on a given issue. We look at the problem and we work to solve it. I really enjoyed my work with the fire district. It's really opened my eyes. I've learned a lot. Of course, I'm learning every day. But yeah, that's been a wonderful experience, and I think it's prepared me to run for higher office.
So I guess that leads into the next question of why you decided to run for the legislature.
Thank you for asking that. You know, that's not something that I'd really planned on doing all that much. I was very happy being a fire commissioner, but I started looking at what was happening in the state and what could be done on the state level, specifically in the fire service. The fire departments all work very carefully with the Department of Natural Resources and the Commissioner of Public Lands. And I think we need people who are looking out for that sort of thing. I've always, as an attorney of 30 years, I've always considered myself being on the receiving end on legislation. And a lot of times, I think the legislation is very well-meaning, but I do think there are times when the law of unintended consequences rears its ugly head. And, different laws need to be changed and they need to be, I think, maybe a little better thought out. But of course, the COVID pandemic is what kind of put me over the edge in terms of seeing a need to run. I take it very seriously. I don't know that everybody does take the pandemic very seriously. I think we have a lot of work that we're going to have to do in Olympia and everywhere else. The one thing that we can't do is go back on it. But what can we do in the legislature? Well, I think we need to have people who are going to be serious about what has to be done, what needs to be done, to listen, and to put the best interests of the public ahead of everything else.
So I'll go to the coronavirus in a minute, but you talked about the law of unintended consequences. Do you have an example that you point to that fits that?
Sure. It has to do with housing. The one example that comes to mind immediately. I am a housing attorney. I've worked in this area for close to 30 years. Last summer, new laws went into effect that made it substantially more difficult for landlords to manage their own properties. Now, the intent on that was to combat homelessness, right? Make it harder for people to do evictions, for landlords to do evictions, which on the one hand, that's okay. But for every housing unit, you know, there's a margin there. And a lot of landlords and housing providers, they don't operate with a lot of margin, okay? They don't have a lot of profit out there. So when you make it harder for them to manage their properties, they're pretty much forced to sell their properties. And a lot of, I'm afraid, and I don't have the data for this, but I am afraid that as it gets more difficult for landlords and housing providers to manage their own properties, that it'll become unprofitable for them to do so. And those housing units will fall off the market. I think a better approach, if I may, is looking at the housing situation itself. We have a 1% vacancy rate in Spokane or thereabouts. What does that tell me? If you make it impossible to do an eviction, you're going to have a 1% vacancy rate. If you make it easier to do evictions, you're going to have a 1% vacancy rate. You don't have to be an MIT economist to look at supply and demand. The problem that faces the homeless to a large degree is that there just isn't enough housing. There's not enough low income or just housing in general available to people. So I think that the efforts to make managing properties more difficult or more onerous is going to have the effect of actually making less rental units available for people to rent.
So what's the solution for that? I mean, is it finding more money for cities, counties, and developers to create more housing units? Is there, what's the solution there? How would you attack
it? Well, of course, it's a multifaceted problem, and there is no simple solution for that. I do think that we do need to take steps to make building housing, to make it a little bit easier. But of course, then that impacts highway congestion, egress, ingress, infrastructure, that sort of thing. So it's a big deal. But yeah, I think that we do need to fund the Housing Trust Fund. I do think that we need to just make it easier for builders and developers to build more housing. Again, I'm not saying that we're going to completely overlook or ignore zoning requirements and that sort of thing, but the way to combat a lack of housing is to have more housing.
So how do you think the governor has done in responding to the coronavirus?
Well, you know, everybody, not everybody, but a lot of people certainly like to second guess absolutely everything that he's done. I have to hand it to the governor in the sense that he's listened to his experts, he's listened to the doctors and to the immunologists, and he's conducted his office accordingly. I'm sure that it's easy with 2020 hindsight to see how things might have been done better. But I think overall, Governor Inslee has done a good job dealing with the pandemic. I'm extremely concerned, as is the governor, as is every healthcare professional who's dealing with this, that we are not at a point yet where we can say, you know, everything's open, continue with what you're doing. But overall, I think the governor's done a satisfactory job.
So there's been a lot of talk about the need for a special session because of the lack of revenues that are coming in because of the lack of economic activity. If you're elected as a legislator, how would you approach the fiscal troubles the state is having right now?
Right. What, $4.5 billion revenue shortfalls?
At least.
Probably the same next year. So clearly there's going to have to be both budget cuts, and there's going to have to be exploring additional sources of revenue. Budget cuts, I think that there are undoubtedly, revenue sources. I think we can probably take a look at tax exemptions. I think that anytime the legislature does give a tax exemption, we need to make sure that that exemption is going to translate into real economic development. And if it doesn't, and by economic development, I mean more jobs. If it doesn't, then I think we have to go back to that industry and say, look, you guys promised us this. We gave you the tax break. You didn't give it to us. So we want the money, the clawback, so-called clawback provisions. I think that's something that we really need to look at. As far as budget cuts are concerned, yeah, there are going to be budget cuts. Obviously, I mean, again, you don't have to be an MIT economist to see that the budget is just absolutely drastically impacted. But I think what's important for a legislator, at least from Eastern Washington from the 6th Legislative District is that we need to make sure that these cuts don't disproportionately fall on the citizens of Eastern Washington and don't disproportionately fall on the most vulnerable vulnerable populations, the people who are least able to accept service cuts. I'm thinking specifically of the elderly and children. You know, like I say, the most vulnerable population among us.
Well, I was going to ask if you had, as you start to think about it and spitball it a little bit, where are the areas that you would be most inclined to look for cuts?
Doug, I think we're going to have to look across the board on things. That's what the special legislation or special legislative session is going to be about. Where do we look for cuts? Again, I want to look very carefully about how those cuts are going to impact those of us in Eastern Washington. Specifically, I think there's going to be a lot of noodling on the part of the legislators. I hope there's a lot of listening. I hope it doesn't devolve into a partisan rancor type thing. We're going to have to look across the board. I will, and let me back that up a little bit, though. A couple of things that we do need to make sure that we're not ignoring, and that is education and public safety. As a fire commissioner, I'm the public safety aspect of it is it's economic. I mean, you want people to be comfortable in their own homes, to live in safe environments, that sort of thing. And then education, of course, the McCleary decision has required that we fund K through 12. I hope that we don't ignore post-secondary education. Eastern Washington University is in our district. There the news articles recently about how hard they're being hurt. I want to make sure that the colleges and just education in general doesn't suffer disproportionately or unnecessarily, because those are education is truly probably the single most important economic issue we have. I mean, if we can't have a skilled and trained workforce, we're not going to have the jobs that are going to lead us into the emerging technologies of the future.
So I want to ask you a question as a fire commissioner. Lance Commissioner Hillary Franz earlier this year proposed a small tax on liability insurance to pay for wildfire prevention and wildfire capacity for a dedicated fund for that. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think you kind of said it when you said a small fee. I think it's a great idea. I'm not sure why everybody's so radically opposed to it. Seems like I'm familiar with the issue. I think it's a good idea myself. We all live in the state. How many summers have we had now where we could hardly go outside some days because of the smoke? That's forest management. One thing about Hillary Franz, and I have a lot of respect for her. She's a very dynamic individual who gets things done, and she pays a lot of attention to those of us in Eastern Washington. I don't quite understand what all the big opposition to that is, given the benefit that we're likely to reap from it.
So I want to ask a question about with Black Lives Matter, and we're past the nightly demonstrations downtown. But how do you feel about police reforms in the state of Washington? Should they be done at the state level? Should they be done at the local level? Let me have you just talk about that, just sort of your overall thoughts about it.
Well, first of all, I'm an individual who, I'm not going to say we have to defund the police. If somebody's trying to break into my house at 3 o'clock in the morning, I want the police there with canines and everything else that they can muster to keep my wife and me safe. With that said, much of what's going on with law enforcement, I think it's cultural. It's cultural within police departments. Somebody asked the question not too long ago, well, you know, there aren't that – how many bad cops are there? Oh, well, there's not that many bad cops, which I'm sure is true. But with that said, is a cop who is afraid to report on one of his or her fellow police officers who is corrupt, who is doing things that are bad – how can that person be considered a good cop? Well, that's cultural. And how do you change cultures? Well, there's going to be some legislation that's required. I think that it can be done at the local level, but it needs to be done at the state level as well. For example, somebody made the observation that when the National Guard comes in to deal with a riot situation, typically things de-escalate and everybody goes home. But when the police go in, it escalates. We have rubber bullets, we have tear gas, we have all these terrible things and the injuries that result therefrom. Somebody asked the question, well, why is that? What's the difference? And the person who was in the National Guard said, because we could weed out our bad apples. If we're looking for people, if they're doing it, if they're not holding true to their oaths of office, then we can get rid of them. And I think the same has to be true with police. Now, what does that look like exactly? I don't know. Perhaps limitations of immunity, perhaps some limitations on what can and can't be bargained with law enforcement. It's a complex issue. It's going to take some time to resolve, but we need to do it. We need to really jump into it and take it on, because Black lives do matter. Historically, Black lives really have not mattered as much as white lives. When you think about it, I mean, people were brought to this country in chains. As upwards of 20% of people brought over to this country died in transit and just simply thrown overboard. For the next 400 years, Black lives were slaves to be sold and tortured and murdered or whatever. They were property. Following the Civil War, the Ku Klux Klan came into being, harassing people of color. Jim Crow laws, segregation, lynchings, all of these terrible things. So when somebody says Black Lives Matter, you have to say, well, historically, maybe they haven't as much. And you look recently in the past, I think we all have to kind of examine our consciences, Doug, and look to the realities here that African Americans and people of color are disproportionately, I don't want to use the word picked on, but maybe that's the word I'm looking for, picked on by law enforcement. That's not right. I think we all have to take a look at that. And I think police officers themselves need to look at themselves in the mirror and suggest that maybe they could back off a little bit. Maybe they don't have to always be right. Maybe they could give a little bit. It's a complex issue, no question about it, Doug. But I think that we can deal with this. We're going to have to.
Well, let me stay with another criminal justice issue, and it sort of died away for a while, but it came back up in Olympia last year, and it's coming up now at the federal level. The death penalty. Do you support a repeal of the death penalty as the governor and the attorney general have proposed?
Well, certainly my opponent is into the death penalty for about everything that you can imagine. But I always say this, and I've worked in the courts for quite a while. My wife actually was a judicial assistant on two capital murder cases. So it's something that we've talked a lot about, at least at the trial level and whatnot. And I always say that a life in prison without the possibility of parole, that's a life sentence. And when we are prosecuting death penalty cases, it has to be done right. If the state is going to take somebody's life, it has to be done appropriately. The costs of putting somebody to death far, far outweigh. I mean, I don't have any statistics on it, but gosh, Doug, it's got to be 2, 3, 4 times as much to put somebody to death as it is to put somebody in prison for life without the possibility of parole. And frankly, at the end of the day, the result is the same. Why give somebody some callous murderer a bully pulpit? He's in prison, get on with it, to the family. And I say that not to be insensitive to the families, but let the families know that he's not getting out.
So let me give you a couple more that are a little more esoteric. The $30 car tab initiative was approved again last year by Washington voters. How do you feel about that?
Well, I voted against it because I like to drive on streets that are drivable. It's funny. I ask people, well, do you want good roads? Yes, you want good roads. Do you want safe roads? Yes. Do you want improvements? Yes. Do you want more ingress, egress from your home? Yes, we do. But then you say, but I don't want to pay for license tabs. So it's a decision that the voters made. who am I to question the will of the voter? But I think that it was a sales job that was done that's causing, is going to continue to cause a lot of problems. I mean, I've lived here for what, 30 plus years, 35 years, I guess. And, you know, the North South Freeway was on the books for 30 years prior to that. We need to get it done. You know, that's a, and you know, you asked me before a little bit about revenue and how do we generate revenue? Well, user fees. I think that a license tab is pretty much a user fee. It's not a toll exactly for going on a toll road, but it's kind of the same idea. If you're going to use the roads, you have to pay for their repair. So, you know, the public spoke on it. I think that we just need to do a little better job about communicating just what those license tabs do.
Would you support tolls?
No, heavens, Betsy, no. Write that one down. I do not accept toll roads in Spokane. So my wife and I, we took a vacation in Florida a couple years ago. Just, I wanted to see Kennedy Space Center. And so we went down there. Oh my gosh, they've got tolls everywhere you go. Just like, no, we're not going to do that in Spokane.
Now, here's an issue that I wasn't going to ask about, but I've been talking with 4th District folks where the 51st state idea was hatched years ago by Senator McCaslin and has been raised again. Do you support the idea of a 51st state, including Eastern Washington?
So let's see. What would that how would that look? All of a sudden, we'd be going from a state of relative prosperity to a state of, we don't, what industry do we have in Eastern Washington? What would be our economic base for a thriving economy? And I'm asking that question, and I don't have an answer to it because I just don't see it. That's just political rhetoric. I think it gets certain people all riled up and jacked up, but I think it's, and I'll just say it, it's preposterous.
Okay. So Tom, I've given you my set of issues. Are there other issues you wanted to talk about that are important to you before we finish up here?
Well, sure. You know, we've talked about the budget. We've kind of danced around homelessness a little bit. I think, you know, that's something that can be addressed. It always bothers me when I hear people lumping homeless into one category. I think that the homeless issue and also the also ties into the police issue is that there's a real lack of services in the public for people with mental illness, of meaningful services. I mean, I think it's just reprehensible that we have so many veterans who serve their country and they come back and they are changed. They bring back a lot of baggage from the war. And the fact that these folks are homeless means that there's a lack of services for these folks. I think that's something that needs to be addressed on the federal level and the state level. We talk a little bit about infrastructure. One of the things that we might have an opportunity to do, I think, is, you know, last year the bill was enacted encouraging broadband in rural areas, broadband services. As we emerge from this pandemic, life's going to be different. We're going to be working from home more, teaching children from home, the telecommuting, telemedicine, all of these things are going to be a bigger part of our lives. And yet there's a substantial number of people who live in the more rural areas who don't have access to broadband. So I think this is something where we can look forward and we can look to see what can be done to fund broadband services to make sure that people don't fall behind because they don't have access to the internet. That's a huge issue, I think. And when we talk about infrastructure, I think that technological infrastructure is critical.